Good morning, everyone. Lovely to be together with you on this snowy morning. I don't know if you've had a chance to look outside, but wow, it is really snowing out there and blowing. And it looks lovely from in here. I'm glad I'm not actually out there in it. Maybe some of you have been out in it today. More of a problem on the outside than it is here in our cozy, snug zendo with good Dharma friends. So, continuing our exploration of our wonderful new fourth edition liturgy book, I wanted to talk a little bit about a piece that I particularly enjoy that's called Who Owns the Weather by Joan Tollefson. She says, "Is there anyone inside this body and mind who is doing the talking, doing the hearing, doing the thinking, making the choices, performing the actions? Is there anyone in control of what is arising and appearing? Is there any owner of the so-called internal weather, someone who is responsible for it? Is there a fundamental difference between a thunderstorm and a burst of anger, or between a cloudy day and a wave of depression, or a moment of anxiety? When is the weather outside, when is the thunderstorm, or the haze, or the clouds, or the snow? It's clear no one owns it. We don't take it personally. But when it's the internal weather, then there's a very old story that someone owns it, that there's a me who has it, who needs to figure out what to do about it and how to fix it. It seems so personal. In this moment, is there definitely a problem that needs to be solved? Or is there only ever-changing appearance, endlessly solving and dissolving itself? In this moment, is there anything that needs to be different? Or is this idea of a problem and search for a solution nothing more than passing thoughts, no more substantial than last night's dreams?" So, in this first paragraph here, some wonderful koans. Is there anyone inside this body and mind? Who is doing the talking? Who is doing the hearing? Who is doing the thinking, making the choices, performing the actions? Who is this? Is there anyone in control of what is arising and appearing? So I notice, you know, I have my my ideas of what should be arising, and what actually arises varies quite a bit from that. It seems so clear, doesn't it, that the thoughts are me. They're my thoughts. I'm the one having them, aren't I? I can hear them in my head, but you can't, I don't think. And yet, I have all sorts of thoughts that just sort of come unbidden. And how would I create a thought anyway? Is there really a me that's doing this thinking, that is planning out in advance the talking, who is involved somehow in the hearing? She asks, is there any owner of the so-called internal weather, someone who is responsible for it? Is there a fundamental difference between a thunderstorm and a burst of anger, or between a cloudy day and a wave of depression, or a moment of anxiety. So, our emotions, they seem so solid somehow. When anger arises, my whole universe is filled with anger. When depression arises, my whole universe is lethargic, unable to do much of anything. And immediately, I have these thoughts come up about how things should be different and how I shouldn't feel the way that I feel. That it's my responsibility to avoid anger. And I shouldn't get depressed. This self seems so solid. And yet, is it? When it's the weather outside, when it's the thunderstorm or the haze or the clouds, it's clear no one owns it. We don't take it personally. But when it's the internal weather, then there's a very old story that someone owns it, that there's a me who has it, who needs to figure out what to do about it, how to fix it. It seems so personal. It says something about me. This is the sort of person that I am. See, there I go again. I'm angry. I'm just an angry person. I knew it. Or, yeah, I really get depressed like this. And, this is who I really am. There are some moments when I'm able to hide it, but then suddenly the true me comes up. Very, very personal. In this moment, is there definitely a problem that needs to be solved, or is there only ever-changing appearance, endlessly solving and dissolving itself? In this moment, is there anything that needs to be different? Or is this idea of a problem and search for a solution nothing more than passing thoughts, no more substantial than last night's dreams? So I sat a little bit with bits of this paragraph. Is there definitely a problem that needs to be solved? And the initial answer to this seems so clear. Well, of course there's a problem. I need to do something about this. This isn't right. And I'm something of a problem solver by nature. And my job as a software engineer was often about troubleshooting. This was my particular area of expertise, in fact. So normally I was, when I started out my career, I was just a software engineer writing code. But when we'd get to the end of a project and it was time to put it all together and try and make it work, suddenly I found myself reporting to my boss's boss's boss. And I was the one who was responsible for finding the problems and fixing them. This is what I did. And so I try to apply this strategy to what's going on with my emotional life. Clearly, there's a problem here, this arising of anger. I mean, I've taken these vows, precepts. I'm trying to do less harm in the world, as we were talking about yesterday, to try and be loving, to try to be kind, to try and do less harm. And what shows up is quite a bit different from that for me. All these emotional pits that I keep falling into. And it's me. So, is there anything that needs to be different? Or is this idea of a problem and search for a solution nothing more than passing thoughts? No more substantial than last night's dreams. I think, so one clue here might be that in the world of troubleshooting code, there's clearly a problem that can be found and fixed. And when it gets fixed, the problem stops arising. But for me, in my my emotional life, my internal weather, this is not so much the case, right? I'm looking for these problems, and sometimes I think that I find, you know, what it is that's causing the problem, and try to do something about it, and perhaps I'm successful at, you know, fixing some particular pattern that I keep falling into, to seeing that and doing something about it. And yet, these things continue to keep arising. Our practice is not a means of solving the problem of me. Our practice is bringing our awareness to seeing the difficulties, and being intimately aware of the problem is enough. No need to actually find a solution in me, because perhaps this me that I keep talking about is much less substantial than I imagined. So we read the first bit of Dogen's Genjo Koan. And towards the end of this piece, he talks about what we're doing here in our study of the Buddha Way. And he says, to study the Buddha Way is to study the self. And so this is the noticing of the thoughts and emotions arising. And noticing how I immediately try to take ownership of these thoughts and emotions, even though I really have no idea at all how these things come up. I couldn't produce a thought if my life depended on it. I don't know how to cause a thought to arise. I don't know exactly how emotions work. I don't really know how to breathe or to digest food or any of these things. You know, I imagine that I have control, but not so much. So we study the self. Dogen says, to study the self is to forget the self. So seeing through these ideas of self, right, really paying attention to what's going on. If we don't look too closely, it seems obvious that we're in charge. We need to do the thinking, to feel the emotions, to fix the problems. But when you really look closely, and this is what we're being invited to do, is to really look closely. Is that really what's going on here? Is there really a self that's in charge of all of this? Are we really the owner? Is there actually a problem that we could fix and be done with all of this? Or is it the whole universe working together to produce what is arising for us? And it's not that we have no control, right? It's not that we're helpless. What we think and do matters. This is clear, right? Our thoughts and our actions matter. And it's not clear to me exactly how these thoughts and actions come up. But for me, I think the important thing is this setting of intention, this vow to pay attention, to study the self, to look closely, to feel, to be intimately aware of what is arising, to pay attention to the bodily sensations of these emotions, to notice the thoughts, to see that the thoughts drive the feelings and that the feelings drive the thoughts. Just to pay attention to all of this, to study the self and forgetting the self. When we forget the self in this way, Dogen says, to forget the self is to be actualized by the myriad things. To leap clear of this activity of obsessing over self. To see through this obsession and to allow the things of the world to come forward. To be interested in what's going on around us, to pay attention to other people and things, to allow the world to touch us. And when we allow the world to touch us, we're moved in this dropping away of me. And paying attention to what's going on in the world, I notice that I am called forward. That there's an arising of compassion. And also a sense of responsibility. Right? So this small self collapses. But that doesn't mean that, well, okay then, so I'm not responsible. For me, the truth is that there is no self in the way that I imagine. But there's also this other side of there is nothing other than self. This whole catastrophe of the universe is my life, Buddha's life. And it's up to me to do something. Maybe all I have is a bucket of water and a teaspoon to put out the fires of the world. one spoonful at a time. This practice of doing whatever amount I can do. It's not about that I'm going to put out all the fires of the world. It's about dedicating my activity to the service of doing whatever small amount that I'm doing, able to do. And even if I end up I'm totally failing to put out any of the fires, at least I think there's a certain satisfaction in knowing that I tried. I did my best. I did what I could do. I paid attention to the suffering, and I tried to make my contribution. And maybe that's enough. Thank you. So, please sit comfortably, and we'll have an opportunity for our Dharma dialogue. Ask questions, make comments, anything about the talk or things that are coming up for you here on retreat.
I just kept thinking of this situation I'm in out in the world. My brother's anger, and it really feels like weather, like it's a storm that's just gonna drown us all. And I can see it like that, and I can feel like, I don't know, I still feel like it's something I have to fix, even though I'm aware of it as weather. I don't know if I'm asking you a question, but that's what came up.
Yeah. Well, so when you go out in a storm, it's good to have a jacket and a hat and mittens. Some weatherproof gear. And just like so storm and your brother storm and you, how do we behave in the storm? So it's not, this is not dismissing your brother's anger, saying, oh, there's nothing, you know, just get over it. This is an energetic field, and so how do we work skillfully with whatever weather we encounter? So that we can be of use.
And I think, too, before we work with it skillfully, we have to be present to our unskillfulness. You know, to your desire to fix it is part of it. And to value that. It's not that you have to just cross that off your list and say, I'm not going to try to fix it. I'm just going to be skillful. But taking a step back and going, whoa, I really don't want him to be angry. It's causing so much harm. I would like this to stop. You know, whatever that feeling is, to give yourself a break there. Of course you want that. I mean, how many of us could say the same? You know, and I think that was what Steve was pointing to in his talk. It's such a subtle teaching, and so well put, but hard to honor the crap that comes before kind of the exhaustion that leads to allowing what happens next to happen next. If you keep, in other words, what I'm trying to say is if you keep trying to not object to your brother's anger, then you get stuck in the objecting to your objecting, right? And it gets magnified.
Objecting to the more weather.
Yeah, totally. And I felt that this morning. The storm was supposed to start at 1 o'clock. In the morning, and it didn't. And I thought, oh, maybe all my thinking that it should go out to sea has had some kind of effect. But I apparently cannot control the weather. But that feeling of, oh, maybe if I wish hard enough, it would go out to sea. And then those first flakes started to, and I thought, so silly and humorous at that point. But I think we do carry these delusions very close to us, that we can be different than the way we are. And of course, we will be different, but just not right now.
Steve.
Thank you for your talk. You've unpacked a lot there. And I just want to sort of open up just a little piece of it, in that what's very strong in our culture is this idea of the individual, okay? Very strong, okay? We get counted, Steve Garabedian, Steve Wallace, et cetera, et cetera. We each have our own social security numbers. I would almost bet that every American in this room has a social security number. Okay, so we get, you know what I'm driving at now? Okay, so there's this sort of this hard encasement, okay, of the individual. And yet, as you've really very clearly pointed out to us, that's a delusion, okay? So this skin that encases this individual is pretty porous. It allows things in, it allows things out. So I think for me, what's difficult is, among the many difficulties that we have, is that there's this sometimes this consensual view. Okay, and again, I'm referring to just one little bit of it, you know, the individual. And then there's the reality, okay? And so if we open ourselves up to the world, we also open ourselves up to this other view. You know what I'm saying? This consensual view. Sometimes it's very easy to get pulled into this sort of very fixed view of how things operate. You know what I'm saying? So, what seems very clear here in the Zendo sometimes isn't very clear when you step outside the Zendo.
Right.
So would you just kind of speak to that a little bit, Steve? You know what I'm driving at?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, I get the toolkit right. When I'm here, and yet sometimes that toolkit doesn't work.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
So I'll leave it at that.
So this consensual view of you know individuals bumping up against each other, this is not exactly false, right? I mean it's a very good and useful way of meeting the world in our daily life. I'm over here and you're over there, and you're Steve Garabedian and I'm Steve Wallace, and if you confuse the two, there's going to be some difficulties, right? And all of that, you know, is true as far as it goes, right? But out in our daily world, we typically don't have the opportunity to reflect on the fact that it's only a partial truth and it's only an approximation of what is happening, right? We assign blame, we assign responsibility, we say, well, that person did that, right? And I know what the source of this problem was, right? But actually, when we look closely here in the Zendo, it becomes a little more clear to us that actually, you know, it's like the whole universe that has influenced me since the day I was born. Before I was born, my parents, you know, the stuff that influenced them and my culture and everyone I ever met, and all of these things all play together in order to create exactly this situation where my anger suddenly arises, right? And we say, oh, well, you know, I gotta do something about this, but it's actually a much, much broader thing. What do I do about my culture and my society that values individualism and causes me to be the sort of person that I am, right? We need to take all of that into account, right? And make allowances for ourselves and others and notice our tendency to assign blame, right? So that one over there is the problem. I understand, you know, I just need to hit back, right? But it's not so clear cut, right? It's not that there's no boundary, it's just that it's incredibly unclear, right? I mean, we can see, so there's a thing here, but it's actually, you know, much wider and broader and all inclusive, this great universe, this functioning. My functioning as a deluded human being is no other than the functioning of the universe, taking the form of me, right? Showing up exactly like this. Right? Can I allow it to show up the way that I'm showing up and be concerned about it, you know, to wish it were otherwise, right? But to realize, so it's not as clear cut as we think, is it? And to really allow ourselves to investigate, to come here and practice in this way is exactly doing that. And yes, you can't carry it out into the world in the same way that we can here in the Zendo, because it requires this, you know, really letting ourselves feel in a way that, you know, when we're out in the world, it's very difficult to really reflect and pay attention to my emotions and here, you know, everything is controlled and calm, and we have this opportunity. So our challenge is, how do we then, you know, take the things that we learn through our practice in the Zendo and start to apply them out into the wider world? And this is incredibly difficult. It's a lifetime challenge to do that, right? But this is our practice, right? Practice and enlightenment are one thing, Dogen says, right? It's not that you'll get it right eventually. It's that the practice is directing myself in this way. To pay attention, right? To feel what I'm feeling, to just allow things to be the way they are, and to respond then after I've done this reflection. And so if we take up this practice of noticing and reflecting and allowing ourselves to be moved by the world, then that is the thing itself, right? And we carry this out with us into the world to the best that we're able. And of course we fall short every day. Every day we fall short. And this is human beings falling short.
And may I just add on to that, that even this idea of carrying it out, we're not really doing the carrying. You know, that it's not up to us to do the integration. There's something about the power of practicing Zazen that we have all these habits. We have a habit mind that thinks it's responsible and knows, you know, how to take care of things. And what we're practicing here is a new habit of receiving, really. So it's not actually even up to us to do this work in the world, but to keep practicing and then going out and seeing how we get caught again and again and again. Mm-hmm. Then practice some more and then see how we get caught. But that idea that we can undo it, in my experience anyway, it's more of... undo the addiction to the separate self, say. And I think I just want to underline something that Steve said pretty clearly, but I want to say it in just a slightly different way, that all of these views of the self are equally true. There isn't one that's better at than another. We really are each other, and we really are no one, and we really are us. All those things are true at the same time. The mind can only think one thought at a time, but the Dharma heart gets to kind of, that those things integrate, and there's a new way of living that comes out of that. You know, I always quote Uchiyama Roshi, one of my favorite quotes, is that no one can fart for another. Very beautiful, if you think about it. That goes to, you know, the skin bag, right? Steve Wallace and Steve Garabedian are very different. And also not. And also nothing.
The one other thing before Ray, the thing that catches me on all this is the blame. Mm. And that usually when something happens, we want to figure out, is it my brother's fault or my fault? Is it my boss's fault? And then we get into this owning. So somebody's got to own it. If you don't own it, then it must be me. And this really distracts us from being able to work creatively with the energy that's present. So when the anger comes up, I can either blame the circumstance of my life. Why did you make me angry? And I'll fix you. Or I can go into, well, why did I get angry? I better fix me because I'm... And this is this other way. If we don't have to have it belong to anyone, it's not that there isn't something that needs to be done, a conversation, or I need to take a walk around the block and cool down, or, you know, there's something actually happening. But if we get interested in the arising of this, and if we're able not to blame, or to even notice when we're blaming and not blaming ourselves for blaming, but that's where the expansiveness, that's where there's some fundamental transformation where nothing changes. Still, the heat, the confusion, but then it's just, yeah, well, I guess I need a raincoat, right? I need better put my mittens on. Can work with it in another way. So, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I've been thinking a little bit about the small self and, you know, and it kind of has, I have the greatest respect for it, because its job is to see that I survive at least the next 10 minutes, you know, so anything that is perceived as a threat, it will react and respond, and thank God it does. However, it's servant and not master, the ability to have it's the bigger self or a bigger perspective of the way things are. The ability to be able to reflect on the activity of the small self and get its information. Okay, no threat out there. No, you know, or serious threat. I need to do something. And value that, and then kind of move to the place of, you know, seeing it. At least this is what happens to me here when I sit. I get a bigger sense of who I am, you know, a bigger sense of the invitation of Doug and the oneness. Oh, okay, I'm not that small self fighting for my survival here. I can relax that hold and allow myself to be bigger than the little self at that point. Yeah. And so for me, it's taking that bigger self out into the world, recognizing the little self is, you know, if there's a threat, will completely do what it's supposed to do, and then let it go to allow something bigger to show up. Something like that?
Yeah, I think that's really well said. I just want to make sure that we understand that what we're calling the little self here is actually not different in size. You know, that it's equally valuable. I really want to keep, because that's an idea that we get in pop culture around spirituality that we just need to transcend. And in second Zen too. And really we need to, I use the word integrate because I think a better word than integrate is appreciate.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
and I think, and that's what I think you're coming from. Without it, you die.
Yeah.
Right? We this reactive self. It's really important.
And I think as Melissa said too, then the danger is that, or the important to remember, there's no one that takes something from in here out there.
Right.
Right. We sort of receive the project. So I loved it when you say, so here is a place where I realize that I'm bigger than I thought. And of course our wish is that we can realize that and practice all the time. In here, out in the world, but who practices and how do we value this intention and keep intention, but not get attached to the one who has the intention, because there's no one who has this intention, and yet we must have an intention, or we just drift down the river.
And, you know, I just realized the thought that I'm having around all this. There's an experience that many of us have. I have it, and I know there are other people who have it, of really getting in touch with this new sense of spaciousness here. Like, it's just like, wow, it's wonderful. And then we go out into the world with this delusion of intentionality, thinking we can maintain that. Mm-hmm. And then the little self, there's a contraction. We need to protect ourselves, and we think, oh, I lost the Zen mind, you know, the whatever, like as if it could be lost. But that's the experience that we have. We tell ourselves a story. Mm-hmm. I have now failed. Why did I spend 3 weeks in a, what was I doing? And look, it just in a second, it's gone. And actually, that's why I'm talking about valuing and appreciating that reactive self. Has to be, it's not like there's 3 different selves.
Right.
That's what the mind does. It makes categories. And so the engineers can solve problems.
Right.
Thank goodness. If we didn't have engineers solving problems, we'd be in pretty big trouble today. And yet, there's this other way. Yeah. And that's what we're learning. We're practicing it. We're creating, I think, new neural pathways in the brain to actually appreciate all these different aspects. It's great.
So today I went out into the weather with a whole new toy. I was like so prepared for it. I've never used a snowblower. And it really worked. It blew the snow away. And it was awesome. It worked up on the sidewalk. It was great. But as I came down here, I forgot about another part of the weather, and that was the wind. And it blew even better than the snowblower. So every time I would go, it would blow it straight into my face. And the snowblower was blowing so fast and so great. And it was supposed to work out there. And I feel like, you know, it's kind of some of the things that we say here and what you guys are talking on. And, you know, my father, I have a lot of issues with his anger too. And I keep bringing my snowblower thinking like, this is the tool. I've got the right tools to address this anger. And it keeps being, it keeps flowing right back in my face. And I still do it. I'll still do it for a while probably. But I just, I think what I think is the right tool sometimes is more the gasoline to his fire than the water. And, you know, I just really felt it out there today. Eventually, it was nice, because Samu does end, so I didn't just I might have. For a while, I really wanted to clear the pathway there, but, yeah, just, you know, this really came together well, so thank you.
Well, and there are these fires, this reactivity we've been talking about that we instinctually think is wrong. And part of this practice is about being burned up. You know, I love that. So we've got our little snowblower. I'm going to snowblow this, my dad's anger or my anger. But of course the universe is, blows it right back. And just what we think is helpful sometimes is, well, let me put another log on the fire and pour some gasoline. That should help out a little bit. But sometimes, and this is going back, I think, Steve, to what you say so beautifully, there's nothing that we can do. We can't solve the anger. Maybe we can act skillfully, and maybe going back to what Melissa's talk yesterday, maybe we can do a little less harm when we're caught up, or, you know, this possibility too that we are burning up, and our job is to burn up completely. And what we practice here in Zen is dying. over and over, and in this dying, in this being burned up, we are reborn. Not that we do it, not that we figure out because we're finally skillful enough, but we just cook and get tenderized again and again. So, thank you so much.
And so it occurs to me that the snowblower actually is the right tool for clearing snow, right? And there are conditions that are favorable for clearing snow, and other conditions where it's not so skillful to be trying to clear snow in the middle of a blizzard, right? So we go inside and we have a cup of coffee, and come back a couple hours later with our snowblower, and it's quite a different experience trying to clear the snow. But this blowback doesn't stop, right? I mean, we continue to run into situations where there's blowback, and right in that moment we need to do something, right? Well, I've gotta get something done, and so we're out there in the storm, you know, trying to blow the snow, and getting all of this snow in our face, and this is life. We meet it as best we can. We get our hat and our gloves and our hood and meet it the best way we know how.
I love that, you know, that this is the teaching of conditions constantly changing. And you said Samu ends and blizzards end. I really believe this blizzard will end. The National Weather Service says it's going to end. Mm-hmm. And when those conditions change, you know, it's a whole new world. So how do we meet the conditions? Who owns the weather? Who knows?
I was struck by the image of the bucket and the water and the teaspoon. Mm. Especially as well because in the new liturgy book, I don't remember the exact words, but we say that our deeds are all we can do, really, is what's important, our deeds. And so having that image of the bucket of water, and that sometimes our deeds are just this teaspoon, is, I found, really helpful as a teaching for my own life. And to realize that there's really these deeds, even the little ones, the ones that you feel are not, that you don't see any results, are to trust that as long as the deed is being done from a place of intention, of awareness, then who knows what becoming of it.
What a wonderful thing, right? This, if people could say about us after we're gone, you know, that we did the best we could do under the circumstances, right? Mm-hmm. That in the end all was lost, right? But this is always true. It's not about you know, leaving a big thing that people can point to as my accomplishment. It's isn't it lovely that if people could say, well, you know, you really did your best, you know, you took the what you were given and you made use of it, and maybe that's enough just to orient ourselves towards all of that. It's this noble activity, right, of using whatever it is we're given. We all have different selves. We all have different capabilities. We all have different capacities. And if we can just orient ourselves in this way, what a wonderful thing.
And that's the completion. Mm-hmm. That this is, because this is, our deeds are our only companions. Our closest companions. Yeah, and so when we act in alignment with what we love, that is the fulfillment of our bodhisattva vow. There is nothing beyond, since it never ends. So then we can rest with each teaspoonful. That is okay. Another one. Yeah, how wonderful.
In this context, I keep thinking about this movie that I talked about yesterday. There's one scene where, and sorry if these are spoilers, but there's one scene where the heroine convinces the hero, who is a physical therapist whose license has expired, to pretend to be a doctor to administer out-of-date pain medication to a woman who's dying of cancer. And he's like, what? Like, every single one of those things I just said are so crazy to him. And she says, no, just do it, just do it. So he does. And then he comes back a couple of days later, and the bed's empty. And he says to the heroine, what happened? And, oh, she died. I think I gave her too much medicine. But, you know, she died happy. And in that moment, I thought, wait a minute. This is not the outcome we usually orient towards. This is the outcome of meeting everything with tenderness. The little spoonful might not cure anything, but it touches the heart in a way that I think that's what's the most important thing for me. You know, we call this fulfilling our bodhisattva vow. It's really letting ourselves be tender and not know what's the best thing to do, and to reach forward with that tenderness towards another person.
And on that note, let's sit for another couple of minutes.